It's the Bert Cohen Show. Issue that's not well known but could affect a lot of people. It's kind of practically no one has heard of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but it may be the most significant international commercial agreement since the creation of the World Trade Organization back in 1995. Our guest right now is Melinda St. Louis. She's International Campaigns Director for Global Trade Watch. Thanks for being with us. What is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and why might it be known by some as the sneaky one percenter power tool?
Well, thank you very much for having me on your program. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is actually a so-called trade negotiation that has been happening for nearly 4 years, completely behind closed doors, and as you mentioned, out of the public eye. The Obama administration has been negotiating this wide-reaching commercial deal with 12 Pacific Rim countries now, and it accounts for more than 40% of the global economy. Japan is now in the negotiations. Australia, Mexico, Canada, Brunei, Chile, Peru, New Zealand, Vietnam, Malaysia. It's a strange grouping of countries around the Pacific Rim that have been negotiating behind closed doors about so-called trade. But when you dig in to try to find out what is actually happening in these negotiations, what you actually find is that there's only 5 chapters of 29 that have anything to do with trade as you imagine it, in terms of kind of setting tariffs for goods and quotas and so forth. The rest is about a backdoor attack, really, on many of the consumer safeguards, environmental regulations, of financial regulation, of Wall Street, of internet freedom, of our access to medicines. There's this vast amount of rules that are being negotiated that would be binding to all of the countries, including the United States, if this were to go forward. The negotiations have been, as I mentioned, have been going on. They just finished their 19th round of negotiations, and they claim to want to finish the negotiations this year, and that President Obama is going to be going to a summit with Pacific presidents and leaders in just a couple of weeks, and they're going to try to announce that they're going toward the conclusion of a Trans-Pacific Partnership. And it's very important for people in the United States and around all of the countries that are part of this to actually have a sense of what is being negotiated in our name and what the impacts would be.
Wow. It sounds so significant, so perhaps historic, the fact that very few people have even heard of it, never mind what the terms are, is rather disturbing. Your organization, Global Trade Watch, how did you get involved in this, and what is Global Trade Watch?
Well, Global Trade Watch is a project of Public Citizen, which is a leading consumer organization in the United States. For the past 40 years, we've been advocating for consumer protection, environmental protection, public health and safety standards in the United States. And what we determined is that actually it's these global trade agreements, so-called trade agreements, that actually impact the type of policymaking we can make here at home on important regulations that affect all of our lives, not just around commercial and trade issues. As I mentioned, we advocate for affordable medicines and for medicines that are safe for people in the United States. Well, what we've seen is that in these trade negotiations, there's a chapter called intellectual property. And what basically that is Big Pharma in the United States advocating for an extension of their patent terms, which means extending their monopolies further than what we have in the United States, to be able to block generic competition, to keep medicine prices high, to be able to challenge government's negotiations with pharmaceutical companies to have lower drug prices in the Veterans Administration or in Medicare, those types of important policies that make medicines affordable. And as you can imagine, that is of concern of many people, everyone in the United States. But in a country like Vietnam, developing countries, where this is basically a death sentence for people living with HIV and AIDS, for example, that would make their medicine costs skyrocket. So that's just one example. Mm. We've advocated for many years, obviously, about making sure that food is safe, food safety standards. Well, there are chapters in these negotiations that allow large corporations to, again, outside of our democratic process, try to put in provisions that would limit our ability to inspect food imports from Vietnam or from other countries in the same way that we want. Those would be considered what they call barriers to trade. The types of regulations that we put in place to protect consumers are actually labeled as barriers to trade in these types of negotiations. So that is why we have been following this closely and trying to, but as I mentioned, it's very difficult. This has been completely behind closed doors. It's totally secret. No one has access to the text. Even U.S. members of Congress who have authority over U.S. trade policy were not permitted to see the text until very recently. Many members of Congress made a large stink about this and finally have been able to see pieces of the text, but under very limited circumstances. But the press, the public, it's completely secret. And in fact, all of the negotiators signed an agreement saying they wouldn't release the negotiating text until 4 years after the negotiations were concluded. And these are things that are would impact all of our lives. And we believe there needs to be a public debate. And interestingly enough, there are actually people who are at the table and who have access to the text. There are 600 corporate advisors who are cleared by the U.S. government. They can have access to the text. They give input. They write pieces of the text. And you can see a list of them on the U.S. Trade Representative's website. These represent all of the largest corporations that have been trying to undermine regulation in the U.S. for years, and now they're doing it through the back door and without any public scrutiny.
Ah, yes. Nothing like transparency, as promised by President Obama.
Exactly.
My
it's
goodness.
Very concerning.
I'm reminded, I must say, of water here where this show is originating from. There's some really good water sources in New Hampshire and in New England, and I believe that NAFTA and other rules were making it so that a local community, if it wanted to protect its water supply, couldn't. Absolutely had no rights whatsoever because these corporate-written laws that had to do with international trade just trumped them all. And when you talk about unfair barriers to trade, so I guess the common good is called an unfair barrier to trade?
In many circumstances, the way that these rules are written, and again, it's not surprising who's at the table, who actually is writing the rules. It's the largest corporations who do not want for us to be able to protect some of these public goods. There's a very insidious provision that's in these trade agreements that is also, we know from a leak, is in the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations, and that is what's called investor to state dispute. And what that means is that a foreign investor has privileges above any domestic company to be able to directly challenge any law or administrative procedure that they believe affects their profits, and they don't have to go to our domestic courts. They can go to an extrajudicial tribunal of three unelected, unappointed private sector lawyers who will decide whether that local legislation to perhaps ban a toxic product or to protect a natural resource or so forth, if they believe that impinges on their extreme rights as a foreign investor, they can demand taxpayer compensation, millions and millions of dollars compensated them because they don't like a certain provision. And this isn't hypothetical. This is in NAFTA, as you mentioned.
Right.
This is in other U.S. trade agreements. But it's going to be extraordinarily dangerous if it's included in the TPP for the United States, because we're talking about all of the cross-registered Japanese corporations, Australian corporations, Chinese subsidiaries that are located in Vietnam. They would have the power to attack our consumer and environmental safeguards at the local level, state level, and national level and raid our treasury, our taxpayer compensation to those corporations.
This is, it's just amazing, really. And I wonder, you know, I would think some of the things you mentioned about, you know, our sovereignty, really, our local and state and even national decision-making being given up to this international, unaccountable group. I would think some people in the far right, the Tea Party, might share some concern about this. Has there been any involvement with those people in fighting this, you know, international overlord?
Yes, in fact, there is a growing concern among
not just people on the left,
well,
I would hope.
Conservatives who are concerned about the structural issues and sovereignty issues. And because of that, there is growing opposition in the U.S. Congress to granting President Obama what they call fast track, which is a delegation of congressional authority to the executive to be able to sign these agreements before Congress has a chance to approve them, and then to just bring them to Congress for just an up or down vote, no amendments. These are thousands of pages of documents. They would have to vote just yes or no and not be able to amend it. And for that reason, there is a broad group and coalition on the left and the right that are opposing this, and it's going to make it very difficult for the president to actually be able to achieve that and therefore to get the TPP through. Because I want to make sure your listeners understand that this is very frightening and it is happening and it's scary, but it is not a done deal, and in fact it's very vulnerable because many of the provisions are so extreme. There is a lot of controversy among many of the countries that are participating, and as I mentioned, there's a lot of opposition in the U.S. Congress to granting this blank check to the administration to be able to finish this. So even though this has happened largely behind closed doors and out of the public eye, attention is mounting on this, and therefore we believe very much so that it can be stopped and that listeners are able to get engaged and active on this. There are mobilizations happening in all of the TPP countries against this agreement from civil society, labor activists, faith-based activists, conservatives, as you mentioned. And so there is a way to stop it. We have a website, actually, exposethetpp.org, that we would encourage people to have a chance to take a look at and to be able to join that, because it is very important to put a spotlight on what's happening now. In fact, actually, just earlier this week, there were activists who did a banner drop about the TPP on the U.S. Trade Representative's building in the U.S., which was quite bold and amazing to see that there actually now is an awareness and concern among people in the United States about this.
Well, people need to be out there in the streets. Oftentimes, you need politics as well as protest to make things change. We're talking on the Bert Cullen Show now with Melinda St. Louis, who is International Campaigns Director for Global Trade Watch, and seems to have a bit of passion about this issue, which is a good thing. You know, it's interesting that greatly increased trade has been a goal of the Obama administration, and, you know, we want to increase trade and help the American economy. Is that not a worthy goal, and does the TPP not help lift the American economy?
Well, that's a really good question, because these trade agreements have been touted as a way to create jobs in the U.S. economy, to increase exports, et cetera. But what's very important is that behind that rhetoric, the evidence does not support it. The U.S. has signed trade agreements. Last year, the U.S. Implemented three trade agreements, one with Korea, one with Colombia, one with Panama, and Korea was particularly the agreement that was President Obama said was going to boost our exports and going to create jobs. In fact, after more than a year of implementation, even in the sectors where they were planning to be able to increase exports, that isn't what played out. In agriculture, in beef and pork exports has gone down, in autos, the exports increased just a tiny blip to the extent of just a couple hundred cars in the entire year. Wow. In terms of increases. But what happens is, what they don't talk about is the other side of the equation, which is the imports that increase. And every time we've signed a trade agreement under this type of agreement with these types of incentives for companies to actually offshore instead of to increase employment in the U.S., we've seen an increase in our trade deficit, and that is a net loss of jobs. And NAFTA, we were told that NAFTA was going to create hundreds of thousands of jobs. It's been a draining. There, yes. One in four manufacturing jobs in the United States in the NAFTA era have been shipped overseas, and they're using the same model, the same flawed model in the TPP. The economic benefits are actually it's at best and disingenuous, and at worst actually a lie. And the cost, as I mentioned, for many of the safeguards that we have in the United States for consumer protection, environment, public health, and so forth, is just way too high.
Now, we all know that the recession, the financial meltdown or near meltdown of 2008-2009 was largely caused by a lot of interests on Wall Street shuffling things around and involved in these financial products, which are highly mysterious and actually cost a lot of people their jobs, their 401ks, did a tremendous amount of harm because of unregulated, uncontrolled financial products. Does the Trans-Pacific Partnership affect financial products like that?
Well, unfortunately, we have seen that there are these very arcane and difficult to understand provisions that are included in these trade agreements that Wall Street firms are very much interested in and have been pushing, that actually does limit the types of regulation of financial services firms that is critical to avoid future crises, as you mentioned. Located in these arcane provisions is what it bans countries' ability to ban toxic products. That is, there are provisions that limit the ability to limit the size of banking institutions and so forth, and to be able to create firewalls between investment banking and deposit for depositors. So many of the common sense tools that are used for financial regulation, many these rules, were drafted in the 1990s during a time of vast deregulation.
Yes.
And instead of learning the lessons from the crisis, what we've seen, and again, this is through leaks and so forth, we know that they're pushing those same types of provisions that would actually allow foreign firms to challenge any of these types of financial regulation that might be implemented. And you know, and it's not just, again, theoretical. You actually see many of these foreign banking institutions writing threatening letters about the Volcker Rule, that is one of the keystones of the Dodd-Frank re-regulation, financial re-regulation happening in the United States, saying that that is a, you know, that's a violation of our investor rights, and we may bring a case and map the case against this. And so, the TPP unfortunately includes those same really problematic rules, and it expands it to again, to 40% of the global economy.
If you just tuned in, we're talking about the little-known Trans-Pacific Partnership. Our guest now on the Bert Cohen Show is Melinda St. Louis, who is with, she's the International Campaigns Director for Global Trade Watch. And right now, we have copyright laws. Each sovereign nation has its own copyright laws, and your organization has been concerned about the Trans-Pacific Partnership proposed copyright provisions, which may really change the normal bounds of trade rules and regulations. Tell us about that, how the copyright provisions may be affected at all. And I would think a lot of businesses would be interested in what the reality is there.
Well, that is another area where you see these trade, so-called trade negotiations is a way of a backdoor way to get for large corporations to get what they weren't able to get through our democratic process through these secret trade negotiations.
Yeah.
Your listeners may remember the large backlash against the attempt to pass the Stop Online Piracy Act, or the SOPA provisions in the U.S. Congress, which was a way for content owners to try to extend copyright and make it much more difficult for internet users to be able to have free use of the internet. And to a copyright, of course, is important for content owners and for artists, et cetera. But the largest corporations that own much of this content are attempting to include in through SOPA, and now we're seeing many of those same provisions included in the TPP under this arcane copyright chapter that would require internet service providers to police the internet in a way that would make it so expensive that would limit much of the content that people are able to take for granted and use. You know, if you small scale copyright violations that, you know, if you post something to Facebook or those types of things, it would require the same level of copyright policing for that low level quote unquote copyright infringement that you would have for these, you know, large scale copyright violators. And so while copyright is important, what they're trying to do it through this through the TPP is to be able to get some of the very pernicious provisions that were thrown out basically through our democratic process in SOPA, and to try to get that through the TPP. For that reason, many digital rights activists are very up in arms about this. There's the Electric Frontier Foundation, Public Knowledge, many of the of the organizations that have been promoting digital rights have been very active in opposing the TPP for that reason.
Well, it sounds like there is a growing opposition to it, and one can certainly understand why they've been a little bit sneaky about it and keeping it as close to the vest as they possibly can. But word is getting out. I guess people should go to what would you suggest people do? The website for Global Trade Watch and what else?
Yeah, we have a website that is exposethetpp.org, which is a very user friendly website to get fact sheets to talk about ways to get involved. Our website for more broadly is tradewatch.org, www.tradewatch.org, or as I mentioned, ExposeTheTPP.org.
Well, thank you very much. This has been very, very revealing, throwing back the curtains on something that they're trying to keep secret. Wow. Thanks so much. It could affect all of us. Thanks very much for being with us. Melinda.
Thank you very much.
It seems some people just want it all. Thanks. Melinda.
want it all. They want it now. They want to get it. Don't care how. Want that Mercedes, that Gulfstream too. They want to get it from you. They want your life savings and your mother's ring. They like to have everything. They want it all. They want it now. They want to get it and they don't care how. They want it all. They want it now. They want to get it and they don't care how. They want that mansion. They want it full of wine and women and political pull. They always have a president or two. That's how they get away with what they do. That's how they do it.
A lot of the money that we pay in taxes, of course, is going to the area known euphemistically as defense, making war, propping up military contractors. We have this huge, huge military welfare system, which the weapons contractors, used to be known as the war profiteers, are doing pretty darn well on, and it never seems to be cut. And one area of the military contractors, of course, is the lovely new toys, weapons systems, always looking for bigger and better weapons systems that somehow are supposed to help America. Well, there's something now called drones. You hear about them more and more every day. And I'm very pleased to have with us investigative journalist with Global Research, Rick Rosoff. You've written about drones and what they are and what's going on with them. What exactly is a drone and what is their mission? And how long have they even been in existence? We've only started hearing about them just recently, it seems.
No, you're correct. I think far too little attention has been brought to what has aptly been called, and I've even used the title in an article of my own, the decade of the drone, to define, you know, the past 10 years preceding this. It's an unmanned aerial vehicle is the official, UAV is the official designation for the drones. And what they are is remote piloted, initially surveillance aircraft. There are various types. They've become more sophisticated. They've also been armed recently and have become increasingly more lethal. But they originally were used in the Balkans in the 1990s. Over the Bosnian Serb Republic in 1994 and 1995, and then with the 78-day NATO bombing campaign against Yugoslavia in 1999. But in the new millennium, in the new century, they've been used as for killing people and killing a good deal of them, a good number of them. And the most frequently used one, you know, the names speak volumes. I mean, there's no attempt by the Pentagon to disguise their intent. The most commonly used drone is the Predator. But it's been superseded by one called the Reaper, as in Grim Reaper, one assumes. And both are equipped with Hellfire missiles, air-to-surface missiles, which have wreaked a pretty deadly toll in nations like Pakistan and Yemen, and most recently Libya, and also, as of late, Somalia. It's been calculated the U.S. has now used the Predator and Reaper drones for military purposes, for firing missiles in six countries. They were initially used in Iraq after the invasion of 2003 and in Afghanistan itself in recent years. So you now have drone warfare occurring in six different countries, ranging from North Africa to the Chinese border in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Yeah. And so the first time, Rick, that these were used was in Iraq after the American invasion 2003, so they were nice new toys back then?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, we have to look at the battle zones of the last 12 years in particular, you know, as being, amongst other things, public hardware displays for U.S. weaponry, which then has a dual purpose, one to convince other nations allied with the United States or that could be recruited into such an alliance that they had better come on board and buy some of their own, or this is what will happen to you. I mean, I fear is, you know, one of the intentions, as cynical as that is. So that initially Predator drones were used in Iraq. Reaper drones have also been used. The United States has also deployed Reaper unmanned aerial vehicles to the East African island nation of Seychelles at the end of 2009, supposedly strictly for surveillance purposes, but one wonders if they're not going to be used a little further north in both Somalia and Yemen.
So these drones, do you, I have, of course, no idea how much they cost and, you know, how what their payload is. I guess they call it a payload for the various different missiles that are on there.
Yeah.
What is their scope in terms of size, weapons, money?
You know, I really don't have the figures on, you know, what a Predator or a Reaper cost or how much each Hellfire missile they fire cost. I do know this, that last year a Marine general was speaking at a conference in the United States and said that in the first year of this century, 2001, the United States had, or the Pentagon, had 200 unmanned aerial vehicles in its arsenal, 200. But that by last year, 2010, they had 6,000 and anticipated having 8,000 by next year. That's a 40-fold increase.
Oh, my.
And again, they're progressing from, you know, the Predator to the Reaper, which has an estimated capacity to carry 15 times as much military ordnance, travels at 3 times the speed, and so forth. And there are yet more sophisticated, you know, versions coming behind that. So what we're looking at, I mean, several journalists have written on the subject of drones and drone warfare. I don't know that anyone has really identified, you know, what a defining phenomenon or development this has become. That, in fact, drone warfare combined with cruise missile warfare has become modern 21st century warfare. When after 60 days of military actions against Libya on May the 20th, the bombing began on March 19th, you know, the U.S. Congress put some pressure on the White House to abide by the War Powers Resolution of 1973. The statement from the White House stated in so many words that what the U.S. was engaging, and keep in mind that towards the end of that 60-day period, the United States had deployed Predator drones with Hellfire missiles to the Libyan war theater, that these actions didn't constitute hostilities as defined in the War Powers Resolution because American troops were not in harm's way in so many ways. In other words, by using robotic weapons like drones or cruise missiles. Incidentally, at the end of May, the deputy commander of the Russian general staff of the armed forces estimated that at the end of this decade, the United States and its Western allies, which say its allies in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, will have 80,000 cruise missiles, 2,000 of which can be equipped for nuclear warheads. So I think combining this, you know, this vast, unprecedented arsenal of cruise missiles with, you know, an estimated 8,000 minimum drones. By the way, I saw an article the other day that says the United States has 7,000 Reaper drones alone. You know, if that's true, then the figure of 8,000 has been exceeded pretty substantially. And what we're looking at, and, you know, we also now have hypersonic, you know, prompt global strike unmanned aircraft in the works. There have been 2 tests for the latest version of that. So I think what you're looking at is, you know, robotic, remote, activated and controlled warfare going on worldwide where troops are not going to be placed on the ground or in, you know, threat or in any way threatening their own, the ultimate force protection, if you will.
So is the point of the drone system protecting American personnel, military personnel, keeping them out of harm's way? That sounds like, in a way, the ideal weapon system. And so it doesn't, nobody has to be on it. It can all be run remotely. But what does it mean to the people on the ground? Is it not true that one of the advantages to drones is that they can be more surgically targeted than other weapons, avoiding civilian casualties?
I mean, that is the claim. But I think the facts speak otherwise. You know, for example, in January of last year, one of the more prestigious newspapers in Pakistan, and arguably the widest circulation English-language newspaper, Dawn News, reported citing defense officials, officials with the Defense Ministry of Pakistan, that of the 714 people killed in what's called the federally administered tribal areas, Fatah, in northwest Pakistan in the year 2009, that only five of those were either al-Qaeda or Taliban fighters. You know, if that's true, that's more than 140-to-1 ratio of other people, presumably civilian, unarmed civilians, or if armed, you know, local people carry arms as a matter of course in that part of the country. We also know in a report from the Persian Gulf, United Arab Emirates, in a newspaper called The National, not too long ago, that in this case, citing a defense official with the government of Yemen, that in the first few days, you know, less than 2 weeks of last month, June, that U.S. drone strikes killed an estimated 130 people in Yemen. The estimates there, again, are, you know, they're not necessarily al-Shabaab, or, I mean, they're not necessarily al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula fighters, but, you know, in many instances, civilians are simply... So if these are smart weapons that supposedly, you know, micromanage the killing, targeted killing, as the State Department refers to it, of, you know, terrorists, however they're defined, then I think the facts speak, you know, to a quite different situation, that in fact there's a widespread killing of civilians. You know, for example, estimates vary and they're hard to get accurate figures on, but since the drone attacks inside the tribal belt in Pakistan began 7 years ago in 2004, estimates are, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,500 people have been killed, but 2,100 roughly of those, 7/8, have been killed since the beginning of 2009, that is since the change in presidential administrations in the United States, and just since the beginning of last month, June, there are an estimated 135 to 140 people killed in drone strikes in Pakistan, which is about twice the total amount killed in the entire year of 2007. So we're seeing an intensification of these attacks. They are not as smart or select or accurate as they're touted you know, as being. And what we're seeing is deaths now in the thousands from global drone warfare.
We are talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Rick Rosoff, investigative journalist with Global Research, about drones. And so one of the purposes is to keep American military personnel out of harm's way. That
It's risk-free warfare. Only the other side suffers in blood and you know, people being maimed and killed.
Well, so how the other side? Okay, it's being effective at that, protecting American troops. That's pretty swell in terms of military policy, I'm sure. But the other goal is, all right, there's got to be some goal of the war, and that's fighting al-Qaeda, I believe. So we're using drones in many different countries. I believe you say like six different countries. And on the ground in Pakistan, which is a very, very important area, and it seems to be teetering right now, you know, we need, as we learned, well, hopefully learned in Vietnam, that if you don't have the hearts and minds of the people, you can't win a war. And so what is the effect of drones on the goals of Obama's war against al-Qaeda?
You know, that's a very good question, and it's hard to answer because everything seems counterintuitive. You know, for example, recent Pew Research Center poll inside Pakistan, you know, found that only 3% of Pakistanis surveyed support the drone strikes. I don't know how many, you know, have some neutral position, but I would guess that means something in the 90 percentile range oppose such strikes. So in terms of the hearts and minds of the Pakistani people, I think we've lost them. And even to the extent that it's putting in you know, mounting pressure on the government to back off its covert support of U.S. Drone strikes. Just recently, the Pakistani government you know, essentially evicted the Pentagon from an air base in its province of Balochistan from where drone strikes had been launched, necessitating you know, the U.S. to shift them to refurbished or upgraded air bases in Afghanistan near the Pakistani border. So I can't imagine in any scenario in which, and by the way, I'm glad you raised the Indo-Chinese parallel. You know, the drone attacks inside Pakistan and the intensification also of not only U.S. but NATO helicopter gunship attacks, mortar and other shelling inside Pakistan, which have resulted in the deaths of Pakistani service men. In many ways parallels the expansion of the Vietnam War into Cambodia in 1970 by President Richard Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
And we know with what results, inside Cambodia itself, and for how long, the Cambodian people suffered the consequences of, that action. Listeners in the United States will recall that, during the 2008 presidential campaign, that then-Senator Barack Obama mentioned on several occasions, and I'm paraphrasing him almost exactly, that if the United States has information or evidence that there are terrorists operating within Pakistan and the Pakistani government is unable or unwilling to take action, then we will do so. Well, that's certainly one campaign promise he delivered on, to the tune of, perhaps 2,100 people killed in the interim.
So... Yeah, and I'm also reminded about Vietnam that a lot of the political pressure on Richard Nixon was that Americans are being killed and maimed in Vietnam. So they had this program of Vietnamization. They pulled the combat troops out and increased the bombing, which, was very intensive. And as you mentioned, in Cambodia, there was this unbelievable carpet bombing, this absolute terror bombing in Cambodia, which... did not work real well. It just made people angrier. I can't help but believe, and I keep hearing, if one is paying attention at all to the news and focusing on Yemen and Somalia and Pakistan and Afghanistan, places like that, there keep being these little oops moments where the U.S. military has to apologize because of drone attacks that kill a lot of civilians. So I wonder... what is going on? And we saw what happened in Vietnam. It only stiffened their resolve to fight for their own self-government. On the civilian population and the political stability and the relations in the U.S. in these various areas. So the areas that we're talking about, Richard, that my sense is, Yemen, Somalia, Afghanistan, Pakistan. What else am I missing here? And how's it working?
Libya.
Oh, Libya, of course, Libya. And how it's because there's no military troops involved, therefore it's not a war situation. This is pretty slippery stuff here. But how is it working with the political stability of those regions? And again, coming back to the fight against Al-Qaeda.
No, you're correct about the slippery slope argument. It's, in a way, a de facto tearing to shreds of the War Powers Resolution 1973,
mm-hmm.
Which was forced, if you will, on the Nixon administration at that time, and may have been, the one good thing that came out of the Vietnam War. If that is now essentially negated, and there have been comments by former U.S. government officials saying exactly that. If you're using high-tech weaponry, then you can, as the White House has recently done, you can claim this isn't war at all because, U.S. troops are not in actual combat situations, and somebody sitting at a base in Nevada is calling in a drone strike in Pakistan or Libya, that this is... a clean, risk-free sort of war. It's a dangerous threshold that's been crossed, and it's a dangerous precedent that's been created. We also have to look at other facts. A report from the United Nations surfaced in the last day or so indicate that over 1,400 Afghan civilians have been killed to date this year, and that's at a higher rate than last year, which was the deadliest in the history of what will soon be a 10-year war. So, if we extrapolate from the figures to date, then what we're looking at is for Afghan civilians, as well as government troops, NATO troops, and insurgents, it'll be the deadliest of the 10 years of the war, which, by the way, is the longest continuous combat operations, the longest war in America's history. It's by far the largest war in Afghanistan's history. By probably a year and a half now, exceeding the period of Soviet intervention, and so we're seeing a massive dislocation. According to Refugees International, an NGO based in the United States, that in the last 2 years, 250,000, quarter million Afghans have been forced to flee their villages and towns, in large part, according to Refugees International, because of NATO bombing and NATO so-called night raids, that is, special forces operations. So you're talking about a dislocation, this is 10 years into the war, a dislocation of a quarter of a million Afghan people in the last 2 years. When they issued their report, Refugees International, a couple of weeks ago, the total this year to date was 91,000, which was a 50% increase over the same period the preceding year, last year. So you're talking about massive dislocation of civilians, destabilization, you know, unprecedented or mounting, you know, deaths and so forth. So, you know, if the intent is to in any way, you know, stabilize situations, even from a narrow point of view of U.S. geopolitical interests, it's been a signal failure. It's produced the opposite.
I couldn't imagine how it wouldn't be. So if it's not really working, not helping American interests to win the hearts and minds of the people in these countries, and in fact is clearly doing the opposite, I'm curious, by what legal authority is the U.S. using the drones in these countries? Do they have to get approval from somebody in those countries? What is their approval for it? Well, obviously Congress hasn't been involved with it. The Constitution seems to have, you know, gone by the wayside here. But how do they get away with it? What's their legal authority, the U.S. military using the drones?
Well, the chief legal advisor to the State Department, to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, is a fellow named Harold Koh, K-O-H. And his argument has been that the U.S. has a right to, you know, bomb villages in North Africa, the Arabian Peninsula, and South Asia in the name of U.S. self-defense, you know, which is mind-boggling. It's worse than that. It's morally repulsive. And that he refers to those killings as targeted killings as opposed to targeted assassination.
Hmm.
And targeted assassination, of course, is in flagrant violation of international law, also U.S. law, you know,
yes,
since the 1970s, and the Senate and House investigations of the Central Intelligence Agency and so forth. So, you know, they simply change the name. You know, the reason they can get away with it, in addition to, you know, very compliant client regimes in countries like Pakistan and Yemen, and the so-called transitional federal government, such as it is in the Somali capital of Mogadishu, which will permit the U.S. anything. The reason they get away with it is there's not international state governmental opposition. There's no opposition in the United Nations. And I'm afraid, you know, there's no mass anti-war sentiment or even substantial anti-war sentiment that can be marshaled in the United States and in other nations to decry this carnage, because it really is. When you you know, start talking about people being killed in the thousands, you know, very questionable targeting strategy and so forth, then you're talking about something that I don't think would have been tolerated or ignored to the degree it is, you know, 20 years ago or 30 years ago. There's been desensitization, you know, of the mass political thinking, I think, in the United States and globally.
Hmm.
And it's time to really, you know, address people's, you know, moral indignation as well as political opposition to these killings.
You're right. It doesn't seem to be happening right now. But you know, it took a long time for the American population to rise up about our war in Vietnam. It did take a really long time after the war was going, and we're just hearing more and more and more about the use of drones and the absolute terror that it's creating amongst huge populations. And clearly, I just can't imagine how it can be achieving any goals in the interest of the United States. And, you know, aside from questions of morality, strategically, it ain't working. What about Congress? Has there been any voice in Congress at all questioning this? My guess is, well, maybe
two people, and you know who they are. They're Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul. And, you know, maybe an occasional colleague joining them. But, you know, for the most part, those are the two voices of, you know, consistent anti-intervention. And from, if you will, opposite ends of the political spectrum, but unified,
sure,
on, you know, on that point, you know, to both their credits. To the credit of both, rather. And, you know, the other thing, too, is we talk about, you know, needing time to, you know, develop opposition to the war as in Vietnam. You know, with Vietnam, after the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and the commencement of direct U.S. and independent U.S. military operations, including bombing of the north of the country. It only took a couple of years for mass demonstrations to occur. This is, again, as of October 7th of this year, will be 10 years of U.S. waging war in Afghanistan. And I'm afraid it goes back to, and let me share, share a brief anecdote. 1999, I was at work at lunch with colleagues at work, and I informed them I was going to the anti-war demonstration in Washington at that time because of the bombing of Yugoslavia. And one of my co-workers mentioned to me, what do you have any problem with that for? No Americans have been killed. And, you know, I fear that, you know, if the U.S. death toll in Afghanistan were several times what it was, you would have more opposition. But, you know, that's the only criterion for determining whether we accept these kinds of actions, which is to say, you know, how many Americans have been killed, and that a quarter of a million Afghans being displaced or 2,500 people in northwest Pakistan being killed is a matter of, you know, seeming indifference, you know, to the body politic and the populace in the United States is really an indictment. You know, about where how things have proceeded politically in the neoliberal age and in the, you know, the 20 years of the post-Cold War period.
Well, we have been talking about drones and drone warfare. Are there any, I mean, there's a lot of organizations out there, certainly on the left. Are there any, Rick, that you can cite that may be raising this issue, that people, if they're interested in, you know, raising the issue of this, you know, antiseptic way of fighting war, of killing a lot of other people and not putting many of our guys at risk, what can people do?
You know, there, if you could do a web search, I just did one myself as we're talking, and I there's a website called nodrones.com, which they made it easy on us.
Yeah,
and
we need it that way.
Yeah, I mean, they should all be like that. And you know, thanks for piquing my curiosity. I wouldn't have looked at that. It's for with Code Pink. You know, with Media Benjamin and Company.
Excellent.
And I see that on their website they're talking about actions against the drones at the Creech Air Force Base in the U.S. with Cindy Sheehan.
Yeah.
So, you know, definitely it's Code Pink. The website is called nodrones.com. I've got to get in there and contact them. And I'm sure there are other initiatives of that sort, but that's the most direct.
All right. Well, Rick Rosa, very, very informative. I'd like to be in touch with you in the future because I have a feeling there'd be other issues coming up as this war on Al-Qaeda or whatever it is that Obama is doing keeps on doing whatever the heck it's doing. Rick Rosoff of Global Research, thanks very much for being with us on the Bert Cohen Show.
I really appreciate the opportunity of speaking with you, Bert. Thanks.
All right, thank you. And do email me, bert@bertcohen.com. Thanks very much for listening.
Just like the days of old, they're in the safety of a mother's arms, the warmth of ages far away from harm again. From the battle fire, the tired warrior aims a little higher. The black. see the gas in machines. It's a war of man.